Lunch with Pippa Hudson
on Cape Talk.
Join the conversation.
Today marks the international annual celebration of One Health Day, which is a day set aside to highlight the concept that human health is integrally connected to animal health and to the health of our planet, and that we need a cross-disciplinary collaboration to protect all three of those for mutual benefit. Now, I can't think of a better example of this concept in action than the author I met last month. Dr. Gladys Kalema Zikuzoka is a Ugandan veterinarian, the country's first ever wildlife vet, and she has devoted her life to caring for the creatures of the Bundi Impenetrable Forest and other local reserves, particularly the mountain gorillas. Now, she is also the founder of a non-profit organization called Conservation Through Public Health, which has done incredible work in promoting the health and well-being of human communities who live alongside those wildlife areas. And she has told her story in a book called Walking with Gorillas. It was my privilege to have some time with her to talk about her story last month. Let's take a listen.
Gladys, you were born in Uganda into a family of very determined, very outspoken activists, feminists, politically involved, people really committed to building a better future for your country. And sadly, that came at a very high cost to your family in terms of the loss of loved ones through assassination. But this was during the Idi Amin era that you lost your father, leaving a very formidable mother to raise you and your siblings. And I was so sorry to hear that you lost your mom quite recently. Our condolences for that. Won't you start there and just tell us a little bit about the role your mom played in supporting you to become the woman you are today, and particularly in supporting your educational dreams and your dream of working with wildlife?
Well, thank you, Pippa. My mom had a huge role to play. First of all, to overcome all that she went through, she wanted to continue my father's dream, and she joined politics, and she inspired in us a desire to follow our father's dream. So from my young age, when I said that I wanted to become a vet, she kept on supporting that, because whenever the animals got sick, I wouldn't go to school until we went to the vet with her. So she knew that I always wanted to be a vet. And then when I said to her, become a wildlife vet, because I felt that even becoming a wildlife vet could also help the numbers to come back and Uganda to develop, you know, through tourism. Mm. She really supported that. She was a little scared about the gorillas. She thought they'll mow me or something. But when she saw them, she was like, oh, the vegetarian giants living in a big salad bowl. So later, she kept on supporting. The thing she did was to lend me her car. You know, she lent me her car to go and pick up giraffes from Kenya. Could you believe it? When we're translocating giraffes through National Park to Kip Depo, when we only remained with one female and two males. But then later on, when we set up the NGO, she lent us her vehicle. She's one of the first donors. She's always been a very hands-on mom. And because I used to sometimes go with her when she was carrying out a lot of community work, yeah, I got to understand how we can engage communities. And I think it kind of had an impact on me. I saw a strong female leader going out there, and it made me to also become a strong female leader in my field of conservation.
Mm. So interesting that. So you obviously had the example early on of somebody who recognized the need for community development and who was passionate about making that possible. When do you think you first started realizing that in order to protect the wildlife and particularly your beloved gorillas, you were going to have to intervene with the humans living alongside them or adjacent to their forest? Because that really became the passion project and the reason for your NGO and everything that has followed. When did those two sort of concepts of wanting to care for the animals and wanting to care for the people first start to sort of blend in your mind?
Those two concepts first started to blend when I was told that the gorillas are losing hair and developing white scaly skin. And I went to visit them and I saw that they were really sick. And I contacted a human doctor friend of mine, and she said the most common skin disease in people is scabies, a Coptic mange. And so I went with a bottle of ivermectin to Bundi. Luckily, I would say luckily, it was scabies and not ringworm, because ringworm is much more difficult to treat in people, let alone wild animals. We were able to dart the gorillas, they recovered. But sadly, we lost the baby gorilla because and it was already too far gone and lost 75% of the hair. But it made me realize that you couldn't protect the gorillas without improving the health of their human neighbors. So we started a program to reduce scabies in the communities. A lot of it is improving community hygiene. Mm. And found out over time, as the communities are more hygienic, they're washing their clothes often, you know, because it was the dirty clothing that they put on scarecrows that had scabies mites. It's why that gorilla group got scabies and another one a few years later. So we realize that as we improve community health through education, behavior change communication, strengthening community health, and actually calling them community conservation health workers or village health and conservation teams, as they improve, the gorillas are falling sick less often from human disease.
We're going to be playing out this interview on One Health Day on the 3rd of November. And Gladys, I mean, the concept of considering that human health, animal health, and the health of the planet are intricately interwoven is something we hear in sort of common discourse today. But 10, 15, 20 years ago, it wasn't so common. When you first said to people, I'm a wildlife vet, but I want to invest in sanitation for villages and I want to start helping with hygiene and with birth control and with access to reasonable health care for the people living alongside Windy, I would imagine a lot of people would have been, to say the least, surprised. There were probably a few who thought, this woman's nuts. Why is she intervening with humans when she's a vet? Did you encounter that kind of response initially?
I did. I did. I got a lot of resistance from one of the hospitals. They were like, you're a vet. Why are you trying to reduce tuberculosis in people? And until I said, well, we're making sure that the people who interact with us come to your health center for TB treatment through our work with the communities, that they started to understand what our role was, because we wanted to protect the gorillas and the people from tuberculosis and other diseases. But there was a lot of changing people's minds. There really was. I mean, there was also changing people's minds, just even in the people among the wildlife conservation community. Why yep. should we be concerned about human health? But also there was changing people's minds that vets can actually get involved in human health care, animal health care, and conservation. There was a lot of that as well.
It wasn't just health care either. Increasingly, your work started to extend into how do we just generally improve living conditions for the people alongside the park and these communities. And that included opening up computer centres, teaching them internet skills, giving them access to the tools that might allow them to develop job opportunities, educational opportunities. And the spillover impact that had was just of raising the whole community up. How much did that change people's attitudes towards gorilla tourism? Because I know initially when Windy was declared a national park, it was a difficult sell to communities. People had been moved out. They'd been told you can no longer go and hunt and cut wood in a forest where your family would have done so for generations. It was a hard sell, particularly coming out of the Idi Amin era where conservation had fallen by the wayside almost altogether. Did that sense of seeing you as somebody coming into my community, making a difference, improving our lives, did that help sell the idea of please support us in what we're trying to do with protecting the gorillas in the adjacent forest?
Yes, it definitely did, because we showed them that we're not only concerned about the gorillas and the forest, we also care about them, because healthcare is a basic human right, and we want to lift them out of poverty. And I think that's very important. A lot of conservationists come across as the wildlife is more important than the people, but we had to really come across and say it's a win-win situation, because when the wildlife is doing well, you do well. And when you're doing well, the wildlife will do well, and you depend upon each other. So a lot of people around Windy Impenetrable Forest believe that the mountain gorillas are their future and they'll do everything to protect them. Even if they come onto their land to raid their crops, they won't try and kill them. They'll try and call the gorilla guardians to herd them back. And we made sure the gorilla guardians are from the community, so they have power over their situation, which is very powerful.
Of course, when COVID struck, you were confronted with the reality that perhaps there was too much focus on gorilla tourism. Gladys, when COVID struck, obviously no visitors allowed, the entire tourism infrastructure just ground to an instant halt. And suddenly, entire communities which had depended for their income on being gorilla guides, on being in the hospitality, welcoming and looking after the visitors who'd come to see them, on being porters who helped them up the mountainside, all of that income disappeared overnight. That was quite a turning point for you, wasn't it, in terms of your future plans for what you wanted to achieve, to see, on the one hand, we've built up this wonderful revenue stream and fantastic opportunities to grow our communities. But on the other hand, all of your eggs were kind of in one basket, weren't they?
Yes, they were. The COVID pandemic showed us that over-relying on tourism is very dangerous, because the Bindi community had come to totally rely on tourism. Mm. You know, the porters, if they carry somebody's luggage one day to the gorillas, they earn in one day what someone normally earns in a month. Mm. And they had stopped digging in their gardens, planting crops, as they had, which was a traditional activity of their parents and their grandparents. And then the COVID pandemic comes, and suddenly overnight, 6 months of no tourism, people were really struggling, and poaching ripped up in the forest in a way that it has never been before. And so we all realized that you can't rely on tourism. But what we did is we started to provide fast-growing seedlings for the local communities. We called it Ready to Grow. Mm. So we give them some food crop and grow quickly between 1 to 4 months so they can eat. And when we gave it to the first 1,000 households, majority of them said people are poaching because they're poor. But among the beneficiaries was a poacher's wife whose husband had killed a very famous gorilla called Rafiki. Mm. And she was very, with 3 children and at the age of 3. And so it's now become one of our programs, and so far now distributed to over 3,000 households, which has been a great opportunity with support from National Geographic, Weekly Fund for Nature, and different groups.
Fantastic.
So it's really, and Wildlife Conservation, but it's helped us to realize that this has now become a core part of our conservation programs, the food security.
Mm, interesting.
And another way that we support is through conservation as well. We support the coffee farmers during the pandemic. Some people are still able to keep out of the forest, because we could sell their coffee to the UK, even if tourists weren't coming, and that money would help us to buy coffee from the farmers. So it should put in tourism.
Okay, so the diversification of economic opportunity there, just providing that safety net. I mean, Gladys, what you're doing is clearly working, because not only are the gorilla numbers increasing, and let's talk a little bit about what those numbers look like today versus when you started working in Bundi. But in fact, the mountain gorilla subspecies is just about the only one who's had its conservation status improved in the last few years. By no means are you completely out of the woods yet, but talk to us about the change you've seen, particularly with the mountain gorillas.
I've been happy to see that during my conservation journey, proud to have contributed to the growth of the gorilla population. When I started out, there were just 300 mountain gorillas in Bindi Impenetrable National Park, which has 43% of the world's mountain gorillas. To add to the 350 in the Virungas, it made it 650. I participated in that very first gorilla census, spent a week in the forest counting gorillas. Mm. And now I'm proud to say that the numbers have steadily increased. So in 2018, IUCN downgraded them critically endangered to endangered, and improved veterinary care, improved community engagement, where money from tourism helps the community. Community health is improving, improved research, which is targeted towards management of the wildlife. And the money from tourism also supports law enforcement efforts, have resulted in the mountain gorilla population going up. And we're very excited about that. That I think we still do need tourism, because the only gorilla species that has tourism is the only one whose population has continued to grow, which is the mountain gorilla.
Yeah.
The other gorilla subspecies, like the eastern lowland gorillas, the western lowland gorillas, and cross river gorillas, are going down because there isn't really much tourism there yet.
Yeah.
And communities don't have an economic incentive to coexist with the gorillas and other wildlife in that area.
Gladys, your book Walking with Gorillas does ask this question very pertinently about, you know, where the balance lies. Is tourism, as you say, a necessary evil? Because I wanted to ask you how you feel about the impact of tourism on the gorillas. Obviously, it requires some gorilla groups to become habituated to being close to humans. And I know it's very carefully managed and it's limited in time span, but the number of habituated gorilla groups has increased as tourism has increased and the number of permits issued has increased. There are still some completely wild who don't have anything to do with humans. But do you regret the fact that that has been necessary, that in order for them to survive humans, you've had to bring them closer to humans and allow them to become habituated? I mean, you've already referenced the potential health risk of humans to gorillas. Do you see other risks in that process? Do you regret in some way that has been the price of achieving this improvement?
I guess to a certain extent, I feel that, you know, those gorillas that are seen by humans are sacrificed for the ones that don't have to see a human being and just can't get on with their regular lives. But it's a difficult one. We do know that the gorillas that are habituated are more likely to get poached because they can't tell the difference between someone who's good and bad. Mm. You know, just like Rafiki, who got killed during the pandemic. But it is a sacrifice that they have to pay for the others. But they're also easier to monitor because you see them more regularly.
Yeah.
You know, you can monitor their health, which is one of our core programs. You can, and we find that tourism provides some kind of law enforcement because when there are tourists in the forest, poachers are not going to try and set snares in those areas because they'll get caught. So it's a difficult balance, but, you know, mm-hmm. yeah. It's good that some of them don't have to see humans, though. And also, there's a worry. If it's a disease outbreak, at least the ones that are not visited by humans are less likely to get affected.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, maybe some gorilla groups may mix in the park, but we typically find that the habituated gorilla groups, which are at the edge of the park, are the ones that have group transfers, and they don't mix with the wild gorillas, which are in the middle of the park.
Interesting. So a trade-off involved, but I guess my final question to you is around the long-term benefit of that trade-off, because Gladys, as you've referenced, maybe look at it as a sacrifice that habituating some groups allows the survival of the subspecies. But gorilla tourism and the income it brings into Uganda also has a knock-on impact in terms of cross-subsidizing the protection of other wildlife, doesn't it?
It definitely does. Uganda has 22 protected areas, 10 national parks and 12 wildlife reserves, and only about 6 of them generate enough revenue to run operational costs. It's normally the first ones, Queen Elizabeth National Park, Murchison, and also Kibale National Park, where the chimpanzees are. Mm-hmm. Some of those national parks generate a lot of revenue, but the rest don't. So the money from gorilla tourism, which contributes 60% of the budget for the whole of the Uganda Wildlife Authority, some of it goes to run the other parks, like Pianupe Wildlife Reserve, which has the only park with roan antelope and cheetah. You know, really, you know, one of the few areas with roan antelope and cheetah. Very important species, but there isn't enough tourists coming there to run operational costs.
Okay.
So gorilla tourism has transformed the country. Everybody recognizes gorillas are very important. So it's a very precious resource, but it really needs to be protected.
That was Dr. Gladys Kalema Zikuzoka, who is a Ugandan wildlife vet, the founder of Conservation Through Public Health, chatting to me a couple of days ago. Now, if you'd like to read her book, you are looking for the title Walking with Gorillas, The Journey of an African Wildlife Vet. It's being distributed in South Africa by Jonathan Ball Publishers, and it is in all good stores now, retailing at close to 600 Rand in hardcover. A heads up, you can get it for about 500 Rand on Takealot as we speak.